You're listening to Sex Gets Real with Dawn Sarah. That's me. This is a place where we explore sex, bodies, and relationships from a place of curiosity and inclusion, tying the personal to the cultural, where you're just as likely to hear tender questions about shame and the complexities of love as you are to hear experts challenging the dominant stories around pleasure, body politics, and liberation. This is about the big and the small, about sex and everything surrounding it we don't usually name. The funny, the awkward, the imperfect happen here in service to joy, connection, healing, and creating healthier relationships with ourselves and each other. So welcome to Sex Gets Real. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Hey, you, I am very excited for this week's episode because it's my chat with Kai Chang Tom. You are in for a treat. But before we dive into that, I want to let you know, I would love to hear from you, your questions, your confusion, your struggles, your celebrations, your request for resources. What could use some attention, support, or unpacking? Send your emails to me directly at info@sexgetsreal.com or by using the contact form at dawnsarah.com, where the podcast now lives. Send me what you got. I would love to cover that in the coming weeks and months. Also, patrons, Kai Chang and I recorded a bonus chat just for you, which you can hear at patreon.com/sgrpodcast. If you support at $3 per month and above, you get access to bonus chats with guests, bonus listener questions, erotic readings, and a whole bunch more cool stuff. There's a big back catalog of bonus goodies for you to check out. If you support at $5 and above, you can also help me field listener questions when they come in, which is super fun. Head to patreon.com/sgrpodcast to support the show and to grab those bonuses. What a joy it was to be in conversation with Kai Chang. I have interviewed a lot of people over the years for the podcast and the summit, hundreds of people doing all sorts of important and rad things in the world. And interviews can be tricky. Two strangers often coming together for an hour or so to try and make something fun and powerful happen. Just like being in conversation with any human in any situation, it can be tricky. It can be exhausting or just fall flat, awkward, or just plain not good because not all humans click, and that's okay. But every once in a while, and I'm so lucky that it's more often than not, but still not every time, every once in a while, I get to be in conversation with someone where the conversation feels easy and fun, abundant and deep, just right from the get-go, where I feel like more resourced and nourished afterwards. This is one of those conversations. I was actually pretty nervous to chat with Kai Chang because she's so fierce and thoughtful. She has such incredible ideas about the world and the ways we relate to each other, so much experience in so many fields. As soon as we started talking, I felt this big yes unfold inside of me. It was just so exciting and so fun and easy. And what you are about to hear is a conversation that asks us to be with a lot of nuance. Kai Chang is asking important questions about things like consent, pleasure, transformative justice, how we do community. We talk a lot about our collective desire to be good as human beings, because we're so terrified of punishment, and why teaching and doing consent from that place may not be the best way for us to move forward. We talk about why sex is always political. There's no escaping that, even if we'd like it to be true. We explore our capacities as humans to hurt and be hurt, to love and be loved, the trauma of being someone who's caused harm. And we talk about Kai Chang's post-apocalyptic vision for how we might be in community with each other in the future in a way that centers relationship and intimacy and pleasure as sacred. I can't wait to hear what you think. Let me tell you a little bit about Kai Cheng, and then we will just jump into the conversation so you can experience it. Kai Cheng Tom is a writer, performer, and community worker based in Toronto. She is the award-winning author of 4 books, all in different genres. Kai Cheng's work on mental health, relationships, and transformative justice has appeared in many publications internationally. You're about to hear why. Here is my chat with Kai Cheng Tom. Welcome to Sex Gets Real, Kai Cheng. I'm really excited to connect with you and to chat with you today. So thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. Like here being like the liminal internet space of video conference podcast recording with you. So nice. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, of course. Yeah, it would be awesome if we were physically in the same space, but you know what? Technology makes it seem like we are. So yeah, I'll take
no,
it.
No one can tell.
So
we're
So here's where I would love to start. I know lots of listeners are familiar with your incredible work in the world, but there are also some folks who may not be aware of...
That's shocking.
I know. What? Who doesn't know? So for people who maybe aren't familiar with you and your work, I would love it if we could start by just kind of hearing a little bit about you, your perspective, the work that you're doing these days.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a doer of many different things. They're all related to me somehow, but I don't know if other people always follow. I am a writer and a performer, and most recently have been doing a lot of writing and publishing about transformative justice and what I'm calling like a political ethos of love. I mean, I say I call it that, but I also don't think I invented it. yeah, like really looking at like what would a political movement or, you know, a radical social movement, transformative movements in general, how would they look? How would they look differently than they do now if they were based on, you know, an ethos of love, which of course is something that really happened in the 60s and 70s in some great ways and in some not so good ways too. But, you know, really in the contemporary time, you know, what would that mean for us, especially as we're looking at kind of, you know, what I interpret to be the end of the world, or at least the end of the world as we know it, right? Climate change, but also, you know, the resurgence of global fascism. And also I think like, you know, the cracks that are showing in global capitalism as well. Like, I mean, as we speak, there are huge major protest movements going on around the world in Chile, in Lebanon, in Hong Kong. It's just like a few of like, you know, many, many places that are having uprisings. So yeah, like what would look like to build a new world based on this notion of love for the self and love for the other. In general, I'm also a novelist and a poet and a children's book author. My big claim to fame is that I wrote a novel that Emma Watson from the Harry Potter movie series. I mean, she's done other things, but let's be real. We think of Emma, Hermione.
Right.
Sorry, Emma. Like, you know, chose that book for her book club. So I get to ride in on a Hermione's glory just a little bit. And yeah, I have been in a past life a social worker and psychotherapist and all of that experience really informs what I do as well in terms of really trying to understand where people are coming from, you know, psychologically and somatically, like that is in their bodies, in our bodies, how do we experience the world and how does it then shape what we believe in and what we do politically? I don't know. I'm also like a body worker and I'm studying sex education and all this stuff. I'm doing a lot of things and I love most of them, most of the time.
I love it. It sounds like the laundry list of things I often trot out. And I think one of the things that's so incredible about everything that you just mentioned, like from writing and performing to a former social worker and therapist to really diving into this transformative justice place and then body work and sex education. I mean, all of that really just encapsulates this like beautiful vision of how we can relate to each other, how we can be in our bodies with each other, how we can experience pleasure all while being so aware of like the political climate in this world we live in, you know, acknowledging that we're not in a vacuum.
Oh, absolutely. I think you're so right about that. And I mean, like, you know, really, I think embodiment, like living in our bodies and acknowledging the living bodies of everything around us is basically it, right? Like, you know, we're doing all these things, you're doing so much amazing stuff, like everyone in the world is running around doing things. But, you know, what it comes down to is like, we have bodies, you know, like everyone else around us has bodies, we are living beings. And, you know, the forces of oppression and trauma are things that make us forget that, right? And it's coming back into the body around sex, around human rights, around, you know, healing trauma and justice, healing the planet, that, you know, is hopefully like where we're all working toward in some form or other. So yeah, it's really, that's where I want to go.
God, it's so rich and so nourishing. And I just, yes, I struggle sometimes with, I've lost a lot of listeners over the years, with people who really want to ask questions about sex and talk about sex and talk about relationships, but without it getting political, right? Without talking about capitalism, without talking about social justice. And for me, they're just so deeply woven together that I can't imagine not doing that.
Oh gosh, I think you're so right about that.
I know, right?
Not possible.
And I think one of the things that I just love so much about your perspective and the work that you do is there's this warmth and this humanity in the ways you talk about some of these really big ideas, even when they're really tender or when they're kind of scary for people. I just feel like everything you do is about like validating our humanity, even if it's hard and scary.
Oh, well, you see me, so thank you. Oh my God. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Really, all that ties in together. You know, you were kind of talking about how, you know, sometimes people are like, I just want to hear about how to have amazing sex, right? And of course that is political, even if we don't always think about how it's political, right? Like, I mean, the huge thing about sex education, of course, is like, well, for one thing, there's misogyny and transphobia that's wrapped into all of the sex we have, and, you know, homophobia too. And like, there is no way that we can have sex and not be impacted by those forces, whether or not, you know, we know it or acknowledge it. And, you know, as a trans woman of color, like, you know, every single one of my sexual experiences, every single one, no matter what, like from, you know, the teensiest little flirtation to being harassed on the street to having sex with someone, is inflected by, like, you know, how my body is deeply fetishized. And that's just, you know, a political fact. It's not going to change, no matter how nice or not nice the person, you know, I'm interacting with, or how nice or not nice I am, right? So it's political. Everything we do, everything about our bodies is political, you know, in a broad sense. And it would be really nice, right, if we could step outside of that. The truth is, I don't think we can. We don't always have to go real deep and serious, you know, like, yeah. It can be sweet and gentle too, but it's there. And I think that's the thing about humanity and like recognizing and seeing people in their humanity. And it's that embodiment thing again, right? Like, to really, I think, be able to grasp the politics of the personal, right? Like to grasp the politics of sex or love or intimacy, which, you know, when it comes down to it, most things are about sex, love, intimacy, right? It's not always in that order. We need to really recognize like that we have like such a fragile, vulnerable, complicated, resilient, yes, but also, you know, wounded humanity, and so do the people that we are in love with or that are hating us or hurting us, right? Like, and you know, we don't always have to feel sympathy or empathy, or, you know, we have to love ourselves and have boundaries too. But, you know, right now and for so much of my life, I've been deeply interested in this notion of like the embodied monster, right? Or which is just to say, like, looking at humanity in its wholeness. One of my greatest teachers, Kathryn Jesse, talks about the soma as the living body in its wholeness, right? And if we were to look at that, then we have to see the body for its capacity to hurt and be hurt, as well as its capacity to love and be loved. And I don't think we will ever, ever be able to get to the bottom of like why people hurt each other, or how even we can stop hurting each other, until we recognize that we are so full of the power to do both, to hurt and to love, to be hurt and to be loved. And that's something that's quite frightening. Like, it's really scary to know that we could hurt others, or that we are vulnerable to being hurt, which is, you know, essentially like what love is. It's like we're open ourselves.
Yes.
So like, and sex and intimacy, right? That's so, you know, I want to go there, right? And I want to know that deeply, you know, about others and about myself and in others. And now I'm just ranting incoherently, but that's where we are. Like, I'm so, so fascinated by our humanity. And it's not just because I'm this altruistic angel who's like, oh, I want to see everyone for who they are, no matter what they've done. You know, obviously, or hopefully obviously, it's because I'm such a flawed person, and you know, that's become known to me in some very painful ways. And I want to be understood, right? So when I try to see the humanity in everyone, it's because of my deep longing for others to see the humanity in me.
The thing that kind of bubbles up as I listen to you talk about that is one of my most favorite things to explore and to talk about, but it's also one of the things that's the most difficult to actually be with, which is just the messiness of what it means to be human.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, so often we try to kind of sanitize experiences, and we're also in a world that teaches us to perform a very sanitized version of humanity in ourselves. And I love how everything you're talking about, this capacity to hurt and be hurt, to love and be loved, and that it's all part of this wholeness of being human, is messy and uncertain. And, you know, it's one thing to say being human is messy, but it's another thing to like be in the mess and to be able to stay there.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, I think you are so right about that. And I love that we're getting to talk about this on a sex podcast, right?
Yes.
Because I think that, you know, the sex positive world, you know, that's sort of developed out of the third wave of feminism in the past 10 to 15-ish, 20-ish years, you know, like internet era sex positivism, often does this sanitized version mm-hmm. of sex, which is, you know, then a sanitized form of humanity, right? Like, oh, we love sex. Sex is awesome. We can just do this great sex and use a lot of lube. And as long as we do that and have consent, and everyone is like, you know, a consenting adult, or, you know, consenting appropriately, then we'll have amazing sex. Hooray. Right. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't come into play with all these huge other questions that, you know, you're bringing in so thoughtfully and wonderfully into your work. And, you know, I just think, you know, like, we're not that. And I think like coming into, like having done, you know, different forms of sex education, especially with, you know, teenagers, I've come to this, like, you're thinking about how deep down we know. And I use youth work as the example, because I think youth are some of the best bullshit detectors and like bullshit killers in our communities, right? Like, you know, youth are like, ah, that's fucked up. You know, like, you know, it's, you know, when we talk about, you know, this, like when we talk about sex, you know, as sex educators going into, you know, youth classrooms or youth groups or whatever, and we present this sanitized version of like, oh, well, like, you know, just like, you know, be safe and get consent and, you know, make sure everyone's enthusiastic and everything will be tickety-boo. Like, actually, youth being the bullshit detectors that they are, call that, right? And they're like, well, no, like, sometimes you can consent to something and have it feel terrible.
Yes.
And sometimes you can consent to something while a part of you is kind of not consenting. And actually, it's really terrifying. Like, we don't always know when we're into something or not. And just because we use a lot of lube and condoms doesn't mean that things are going to be safe or feel nice or go the way we expected. And, you know, so sex is this microcosm of mm-hmm. of that thing you're talking about, like where we it's impossible to sanitize. I mean, how could you possibly sanitize sex? It's like, kind of like very often fluid-based exchange of intimacy where people do get hurt. And I think the whole poetic, you know, humanity of intimacy is that we open ourselves to wounding. And when things work out right, we instead receive this beautiful gift of connection. And there's no way to do one without the other, to get intimacy without vulnerability. We must have both.
Yes. Yes. And I really appreciate, well, one, just the magic that is teenagers saying, no, but also just the truth that is, we can consent to something and then it doesn't feel good, or it's actively bad, or we can not really consent to something and still experience pleasure, or there's all these gray spaces. We may not know how to recognize the power in the room, and then afterwards it feels icky, but we don't have the language for it. I mean, and then just literally the messiness of sex with the sweat and the tears and the spit and the who knows what else is, you know, going all over the place. Like, that is, those are the kinds of conversations I'm so interested in us, maybe not necessarily having the answers for, but being able to ask and then just be in together and to feel into that discomfort of like, yeah, that's real.
Oh, you're so right. I love the relational approach to sex education and sex navigation. Like, tools are really important. And I love the strategies and tools that come out of the sex education world, right? Or you know, out of, you know, feminist approaches to sex education. But we also, when we create like tools and strategies and like little resource lists and cute zines about, you know, which lube to buy or how to apply it, right? Like, we run the risk of falling into like a mechanistic view of sex and sexual consent and desire and intimacy, which is like, if you do all the right things, create the right formula, push all the right buttons on the body, right? Like, then you're going to have amazing sex. When the truth is, that's just not ever possible. And I think the more important thing when it comes to safer intimacy, or, you know, healing intimacy, is building relationship, right? Like, having that, trying to create trust, trying to create vulnerability, trying to create truth and authenticity. And the rest will follow, right? Like, you know, we obviously need facts and, you know, tools and strategies too, but I think relationship is the most important thing when it comes to creating, like, you know, a world that is truly, you know, affirmative of sex and pleasure when we want it.
Yeah, and just hearing you kind of talk about like how easy it is to slip into this mechanized view of sex, where if we tick all the boxes, then good things happen. I find that when we're trying to kind of shortcut the relationship stuff, like we're trying to bypass the awkward, get around the uncertainty, not have to say the thing that's kind of scary, and we kind of fall back into that, well, I ticked all the boxes, there's this very slippery slope of one, being able to kind of say, well, I did all the things you told me to, so I don't have to take responsibility for what came next, but also this potential for like victim blaming, right? We did all the things you said we needed to, and so it's your fault that this happened, or it's not my fault that this happened. And so I really love how you're talking about this relationship and these relational opportunities of valuing other people's humanity and yes, the tools and the strategies, but that messiness is just a part of us being able to see these other human beings for who they are, which is like imperfect, changing, not sure. And if we can meet in that space, then I think there's so much more potential.
Absolutely. And I mean, like, of course, I think that the desire to like fall quickly into like, oh, well, like this is the strategy or the formula or the button or whatever, like then we'll have everything right if we just do those things, like that is an anxiety, right? Like that's us wanting to be good and free of blame. So we're like, well, this is the way to be good. And humans love that thing. Like, it's not just about sex, right? Well, yes. I really think sex is a microcosm of the entire social world, right? Like, it's, you know, we create that about moral goodness, like, you know, intense religious doctrines have that too. So does intense social justice doctrine, feminist doctrines, all this, you know, kind of stuff. And it makes me just think of, in interactions in my own life, for example, where I've had sexual partners who were really anxious about consent, like so anxious, and they would like check in a million times and like email me, and they're like with these like, hundreds of word long emails about like how making sure that I was consenting. And I was like, this doesn't even really feel about me. This just feels like you having some, anxieties about your own, being or capacity to harm, and actually projecting it onto me. And that's actually the opposite of what you want, which is for me to be free to give you my truth, right? And vice versa, of course, right? And that fear is, again, to like kind of, expand our conversation to the transformative justice piece, is like, I think it really comes from our fear of punishment and a society that is extremely punitive about not being good. And by good, I mean like pure, perfect, sinless, whatever. Having spoken a lot with youth as a former youth worker, like a thing that came up many, many times, particularly with like masculine identified folks, but everyone, is this fear of being the abuser, right? Or fear of being a perpetrator. Because, I think something we have not done well as, the millennial generation of sex educators or, third wave feminist sex educators, is we have maybe inadvertently created a really prohibitionist understanding of consent. Don't do anything that you don't have enthusiastic consent for, because then you will be a rapist, is basically the bottom line, which is, on the one hand, a very important truth. And also, when we teach it to, again, coming back to young people, right, like, it's quite scary and doesn't actually empower young people to know what consent is. We know what it is not, but we don't know how to acquire it outside of this, it must be check, enthusiastic, check, ongoing, check, informed, check, within the appropriate power dynamic. And does not leave room for actually, consent is a moving target, and might check all those boxes and not produce a perfect consent. And that doesn't mean, I'm going to take a risk here and say, that doesn't mean that everyone who, kind of slips through a boundary around that is a horrible monster who needs to be rejected from society forever, which is, by the way, the mainstream conception of sexual predation, and is something that most feminist thought traditions have carried on. But actually there's a human there who might want to be better, or, making better decisions. And of course there's a spectrum of boundary violation in sex and in life. And obviously there are different consequences to, different extremes, but I'm really curious about how much better would we be at consent, or worse, an open inquiry, how much better or worse would we be at consent, at giving each other pleasure, at treating each other well, if we did not live in such a punishment-based society? Mm-hmm. What if the motivation for pursuing consent was truly and freely, I want to be good for others, as opposed to, I don't want to be bad, so I'm just going to follow all the rules.
Yeah. The truth is, I don't have time in my life to do all the things that need to get done. Finding small ways to ensure I have plenty of time for play, for sex, for rest, for eating good food is a really important part of how I keep going while literally juggling multiple companies and long work days and weeks without multiple days off in a row. And that's why I've been a huge fan of Lola for so long. Lola is a female-founded company offering a line of organic cotton tampons, pads, and liners, and they offer sex products now too. They are generously sponsoring this show this week, and listeners, you can get 30% off your subscription. So here's how Lola helps me avoid period and sex crises. Their subscription is fully customizable. You can choose your mix of products, pads, tampons, liners, the mix of absorbency, the number of boxes, how often they deliver, and I will add in these really discreet and very pretty little boxes. Lola's subscription is super flexible. You can change it, you can skip it, you can cancel your subscription at any time. So if I'm traveling for a few weeks and I won't need it that month, I just adjust my subscription and there you go. Super easy. Plus, it's not just period products. The Sex by Lola line is totally available for prescription too. You can add it to your period subscription. So then everything is conveniently delivered on your ideal schedule. And I love their ultra thin condoms, which is something I'm always on the lookout for. So definitely check that out. And you know me, ethics are hugely important to me. So I also love that every single purchase allows me to do good too. Lola donates period products to homeless shelters across the United States with each purchase you make. I also think it's worth noting the FDA does not require brands to disclose a comprehensive list of ingredients in their period products, so most companies don't. Lola offers complete transparency about the ingredients found in their tampons, pads, liners, and wipes. You've heard me rant and rave about the importance, the importance of high quality lube, non-porous toys, and now you can be confident about what's in your period products too, because our genitals deserve the very best. If you want your period products and even condoms, lube, and wipes delivered to your door on your schedule with a company that believes in centering the health of your body, check out Lola. Because listeners, you get 30% off your first month's subscription. Just visit mylola.com and enter SGR30 when you subscribe. That's mylola.com. Fill your cart with goodies on the schedule you want. Enter the discount code SGR30 at checkout and save 30% off your first month's subscription. Thank you to Lola for supporting the show. It means so much to me, and I hope all of you listening jump on that massive discount. Tell your friends, tell your family members. Anybody who is either engaging in sex or has a period could use this service, and it lets Lola know that this is a show they should continue partnering with, which helps me so much. Back to my chat. I love the generosity that's inherent in that question. How can we show up for each other? How can we make this something that's about creating, whether it's this one-time hookup or a lifetime of relationship, rather than I'm doing all of the things to avoid something and or because I'm terrified of asking, I'm just going to take, which is kind of the two places I think that sometimes people go. And absolutely. I love this invitation around, like, what if we weren't all so terrified of being ostracized and kicked out and not having belonging and never getting to come back to the event if we make a mistake? And what becomes possible when I know I'm going to be supported when I fuck up, and I will fuck up multiple times.
Oh, totally, totally. And which is not to say the fucking up is okay, right?
Right.
Like, you know, depending on the fuck up, it might be more or less okay, right?
But, right.
Like that it, we could, that it, we could do it. And I mean, also, I just think on a practical level, we'd be much more open to like copping to, or like, you know, opening up about mistakes we have made, admitting them, like if we weren't, if the punishment wasn't this blanket, like kind of you're banned for life or scarred for life kind of situation.
Yeah. So many things would have to change to allow for more nuance.
Oh yeah.
You know, yeah. It's fundamentally like destabilizing to the world as it is to start approaching interactions and community in that way.
Yes, I think so. I mean, you know, we live in a society where the notion of punishment as the best teaching tool for goodness is deeply embedded, right? Mm-hmm. Like whenever someone commits a crime, what do we hear teachers say? What do we hear judges say, doctors say? There must be consequences.
Yeah.
Well, like, okay, when we hurt someone or when we harm someone, there already are consequences. The first being someone is harmed, right? And then the second being like, oh, well, there's a social fallout to that. There are natural consequences to harming people, but that's not what we mean. We mean someone must be punished. And there, we mean that almost uncritically without thinking about, does punishment help survivors of harm heal? Like, I would argue mostly no. not always, you know, everyone has a different experience, but mostly no. And does punishment prevent future harm? And we know for sure with, you know, like looking at statistics around crime and crime recidivism and all this kind of stuff. No, like having a punitive approach, having prisons and putting people in prisons, doing the death sentence, you know, none of those things actually reduce rates of crime. In America, where there are more prisons per capita than any country in the world, where also is a massive crime rate, right? And also, I mean, we have to be critical about like, what is this crime? Like, a lot of it is, like police profiling and like folks of color doing things that they need to survive that don't really harm anyone except capitalism, right? But like, you know, this is a bigger conversation. You know, we'd have to change everything. But I also like to think about how, you know, transformative justice and restorative justice and the notions of like bringing people back into community after making mistakes and the notion of redemption especially are not new. You know, there are many, many indigenous traditions, indigenous to North America, but also indigenous, you know, around the world where folks did not do like the type of punishment culture that was like, someone has to leave forever, or someone is, you know, executed. There were other solutions, right? I mean, restorative justice has its many of its roots and beginnings in indigenous community in North America. And then, you know, the concept of mercy, forgiveness, repentance, and healing actually are part of the interesting mess that is Christianity, right? Yeah. Like, I could say, I hope I could say this because I was raised Christian, right? Like, that we have this interesting weird double standard, double bind or something where all we have to do to be forgiven in the eyes of Jesus Christ is to acknowledge what we've done, right? Yeah. And then to want to be better. And that's actually very beautiful. And then, I don't know, we also weirdly have in Christianity the notion of hell.
Right.
you know, it's a bit weird, but like all this to say, the notion of redemption or like being able to come back into community after harm is ancient. We see this in, you know, in archetypal stories. You know, it's not that it's easy. After we do great harm, we have to go and maybe, you know, do great work, right? But it's there, it's possible, and knowing that it's ancient means that also it can come again. It could be at the forefront of our world.
I love that you said just under your breath, and that's not easy. And what that brings up for me is there's this seduction in our desire for things to be easy and to be something that we can just check off a list, especially when we're inside of a culture that is like working us to death. Right? When life is already hard. And so many of us live paycheck to paycheck or worse, when we know we won't have a lot of social help when we acquire a disability or as we age or whatever the things are. And inside of capitalism and neoliberalism, where, you know, we're so isolated and we really feel like we have to do it all on our own. Like, of course, moving towards easy is going to feel seductive because so many of us already feel so exhausted and overwhelmed by life. And so I love that. And it's not easy, which begs the question, you know, how much resilience do we have? How much tolerance do we have for being able to be in a place that maybe doesn't have an immediate resolution? And where maybe the answer is, we're not sure, maybe we have to figure it out together. And like there's so much richness in that, but also asks for us to move at a different pace and in a different frame of time.
Oh God, this is like the best and most difficult comment question. Yes. You know, I really recommend folks who are interested in transformative justice and particularly around like sexual violence or intimate partner violence to look into the work of Leah Lakshmi Pyepsna Samara Sinha, Mia Mingus, Adrienne Marie Brown, and particularly Maryam Kaba, all like badass femme of color, I believe. Well, not all of them identify as femmes. All badass like people of color, you know, community workers and writers who've been thinking about this for much longer than me. And one of the best kinds of wisdoms that I've kind of learned from the work of those folks is like transformative justice takes time. Yeah. And also it takes a patience and like a willingness to accept the unknown, right? Like we don't know how it's going to end. We don't know what the outcome is going to be, you know, necessarily. Mm-hmm. And we're not all, we're certainly probably not all going to feel like, yay, happy, amazing afterward. Like that's not the kind of idealism that we're talking about here. We need to be able to understand that change, true change, you know, in the heart of a human being or in the body of a human being takes time, you know, like yeah. Something I think we're just starting to recognize as a culture is that trauma recovery could be a lifelong process. It doesn't have to be, but it certainly isn't like a, you're cured tomorrow. And if that's true of those of us who have survived harm, which I would argue is most everyone to some extent, it makes sense, you know, a kind of terrible sense that the change it takes to shift out of harmful patterns, to recognize the harm that one does, to make amends, if that's ever possible, which it might not be, well, that too would take a long time. And I mean, now I'm getting into even more kind of dangerous territory, but I would really venture to say that being a hurtful person, which again, I think we all are, just to, you know, different extents on like a spectrum, is a trauma in itself, right? Yeah. And like, it's a process of healing to become better for others. And that does take a lot of time and it takes a lot of support. Like I don't know anyone really who has made that shift without the support of at least one loving, you know, unconditionally loving person. And man, is that ever a hard reality to kind of mobilize or to accept, like that in order to do, to offer that kind of possibility of change, we might need to really start to love, you know, people who have done harm in an unconditional way. That is very, very challenging.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I love that you named Mia and Leah and Adrian and Miriam and so many other people who are doing this amazing work. People who listen to the show have definitely heard their names before. Oh, and yeah, they're people that, you know, I personally really admire and have been learning from. And I know a lot of people actually come to you for learning and for advice. And as we've just been massively geeking out for the last half hour, like you have such huge, beautiful, nuanced ideas. And one of my favorite things that I did while I was prepping for talking with you was getting to read through the Ask Kai advice for the apocalypse column that you do, where you really talk about so many of these things. Like you've answered questions about community accountability, about harm and microaggressions, about resilience and feeling left out in polyamorous relationships and so many things. And I would love to know, as someone who's on the receiving end of people saying, can you help me with these big, messy, nuanced questions? Like, what are some of the things that you've really enjoyed kind of getting to answer? What have you been learning? What are you still hungry to explore? What's that been like?
I love this question. I mean, I adore writing my column. Thank you so much for reading it. It's been such a gift, and I really have to, you know, thank Extra, really historically very significant and also just wonderful queer LGBT newspaper here in Canada. Like Extra has such a long history, you know, many controversies too, but that's any good newspaper. Gotta shout out the newspaper and my editors that are just giving me this opportunity and helping me really shape the column into what it is. I felt so grateful that people have felt like they could just write to me, a random stranger, like with some very sensitive and important questions. I mean, I've really loved how far people are willing to go with their questions. Like, as you've mentioned, there have been questions about, like, what do you do when your best friend has been named as a perpetrator of harm? What do you do when it feels like call-out culture is tearing apart our communities, and like really being brave with those questions? Because it, like, there would be brave to be asking oneself alone in private or with a therapist or something, but it's especially brave to ask them in public. And I know those letters are anonymous, but like, but the anonymous writers still, I imagine, you know, see them being put out in public and see the online responses. So I think that's really generous and brave. And so, you know, what I've enjoyed is being able to lean into my own project of being braver and more generous as a practice in life, which, you know, I talk a good game at, but also like I experience my own shortcomings in that area for sure. Mm-hmm. Right. So really, like, if someone is asking me what to do when their friend has been named as a perpetrator, then I get to really lean in and be authentic about, like, well, what do I think about that? And you know, how has my experience of a community accountability really differed from, like, the ideals that we kind of talk about all the time, right? Like, really exposing, you know, myself and my own narratives of, like, how it is messy. And to be honest, that is quite scary sometimes. And the payoff of that, or the gift of that, is that I get to live in greater integrity, I guess I would call it. And like, I think that's something about the relationship between me and those folks who are, you know, writing questions. There's something really special about that we get to lean into our integrity together for this brief moment, you know, in the column space. So that's amazing. I just also love how thoughtful the questions are. I mean, what do I want to write more about? I want to write more about, like, all this stuff. Like, I wish, you know, like how, well, I just assume that, you know, but maybe I shouldn't. Like, you know, living in queer community and, like, in a radical movement culture, like, I came up in, like, a very kind of intense radical Montreal anarchist community, actually, and I still have, you know, kind of roots in that and all this kind of stuff. We would often have conversations in private that we would never have in public. Mm. And I think that's really true right now of the entire world. Like, post the initial wave of the Me Too movement, and I think we're still in a Me Too moment, and hopefully, right, we are still in one, right? Like, or, you know, in this moment of revolution general, there's the politics that are acceptable to talk about in public.
Yeah.
And then there's the questions about our politics that we only have in private. And if we keep them in private, then, you know, I think that we will never be able to have the public conversation that we need to be having. Yeah. So I just want more of that. You know, like, what are those questions people are talking about with their friends that they're like, oh, we would never put this on Facebook or never on Instagram or whatever, certainly never on Twitter. Like, I want those questions in my column. And the great thing is that it is anonymous, right? So you know, the direct consequences can be alleviated for the writers, not for me, but, like, I'm cool with it.
Well, there have to be folks who are willing to be courageous enough to be visible.
I think so. I don't know how I chose to, like, try and be that person. You know, it happens.
And thank goodness it did, because I'm telling everyone listening, please go check out this column. I will have a link in the show notes, because there's just such beautiful conversations happening, and I can't wait to see what else comes next.
Oh yeah. And send in their questions.
Yeah. Send in questions.
All the questions.
Heck yes. One of the things that I think is so beautiful about your writing, your poetry, your perspective is around, one, focusing on, like, trans brilliance and resilience, but also humanity. And as you mentioned, this ethos of love. And I know there's lots of listeners of the show who are trans and non-binary and genderqueer and disabled and all sorts of wonderful, beautiful humans moving through the world in a way that's often experienced, you know, very violent, or in a way that where they're very marginalized and have not a lot of access to resources. And I get a lot of emails from people that are feeling really isolated and alone, you know, kind of in a grander sense, but also just around sex and relationships. And as someone who's a dreamer, mm-hmm. I would love to know, what kind of a world are you dreaming? Mm-hmm. Where might we end up?
Like, in in like an ideal kind of fantasy?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I you can share like shorter, more practical, but like when you dream about the future that you hope we all live into, what does that look like?
Oh yeah. Forget the practical. Who cares? So we need the practical, but what is exciting to me is the fantastic. You know, I've always been like a lover of speculative fiction and fantasy sci-fi stuff. Octavia Butler's experiencing like a resurgence of popularity right now, as well as, you know, many Black and racialized fantasy and spec fic authors. And I think this is because more than ever, we are in a time where folks are looking for important, powerful, inspiring fantasies of what the world could look like. So all that to say, you know, I am super dreaming of a new world that is like also an older world, right? Like one that like some of the pieces of the world that existed before, you know, colonization and capitalism like clenched us, right? In this like awful iron fist that we live in, where everything is always scarce and where we always have to answer a million emails and like any consumer choice we make is bound to hurt someone or something, right? Like we live in this horrible trap where just going out to get food at the grocery store, we have to think about like who is being exploited by all these companies. And you know, if we're, you know, what about the animals and what about the earth and like all this stuff, you know, like it's this awful mess, right? Where we don't have real agency except over what we choose to buy. And we don't really have agency over that either, right? Like this like kind of desperate kind of world where rent is always rising and, you know, everyone has to have a million jobs. So like, yeah, I'm dreaming of a world where honestly, like, where we overthrow the government.
Yes.
The government just gets overthrown. And so do the major corporations. I dream of like an anarchist world, like not an anarchic world, but an anarchist one where like people form, you know, self-government out of, you know, mutual agreement about like what we want our world to look like, where small community matters. And we're free, right? Like to make the choices we want to make in our lives, to move freely across the planet, you know, in a sustainable way. If I really think about like the shape of this fantastical world, I dream, actually what I think about all the time is this, like, I do thought experiments with this kind of imaginary city state in my mind. Like that's the kind of the scale I can think at, like, of like, you know, in the post-apocalyptic world where, yes, probably things have been ravaged by fire and you know, terrible weather stuff and you know other horrors, like out of that maybe there's a beautiful community arises that is local, right? And you know, really has learned to like build stuff in a sustainable way, to like use the like nuclear waste and like the all the like stuff that, you know, is the apocalyptic aftermath to form, you know, sustainable housing and infrastructure and all this kind of stuff, where we remember the old ways, right? Like of connecting with spirit and animism, the world, and you know, it is based on like an ethic of love, like where everyone is, you know, where we've been forced to think about sustainability so much that we've learned that nothing is disposable, not the food we eat or you know, the elements of like the materials we use, and certainly not the people we live with, right? Like that every single person is precious, and that doesn't mean that they don't always need to be, like they don't sometimes need to be confronted or, you know, even, you know, stopped from doing hard things, but that we really take the time to do things in a loving way. That, you know, I'm imagining all of that, and I'm imagining it would also be very hard, you know, like, you know, I think about all the time, like, how would that work and what would it look like? And, you know, what would the economy be? And yeah, it always changes because, you know, I don't have the answers.
But. When you think about this future post-apocalyptic, sustainable, local, beautiful community, what role do you see pleasure playing?
Oh, wow. Wow, what a great question. No one asked about pleasure. Everyone should ask about pleasure.
I agree.
Well, I think that pleasure would be sacred, like truly sacred, in this post-apocalyptic community. Like, this in my mind, this like fictional community would recognize how deeply suffering has been ingrained in the cultures and societies of the past, right? Like this, like we have to punish in order to teach, and all of life has to be suffering, right? Like this sort of like, you know, how does capitalism incentivize people through deprivation, right? Like, you know, you have to get a job, otherwise you'll starve, like that kind of suffering. And like to know that, of course, life in general is full of suffering, and that pleasure is this beautiful thing, this fleeting moment that we have to treasure and cultivate where we can get it and where we can create it. And that, you know, the greatest possibilities for pleasure often lie in intimacy, right? Like touch, exchange, interaction, and that we would really hold that as like a sacred art that we would teach, you know, to children and to pass on through elders and hone over our lives. Yeah, like really teaching pleasure in all of its forms. And you know what, like as long as we're kind of going off on beautiful tangents, I think that sex workers and sex educators would be restored to, yeah, you know, their ancient role as keepers of the sacred, right? Like keepers and teachers of pleasure. You know, Ursula K. Le Guin, you know, the famous and, you know, now sadly departed specfic author, talks about in her series, her Powers trilogy, about, you know, humans who have magical gifts, like magical gifts that are used for war. And this one character goes, you know, maybe we've been using the gifts wrong this whole time. Like maybe they weren't meant to hurt, but to heal. And like the power to break a bone with your mind actually is meant to be this thing where, like a medical gift, right? And I think that about sex and pleasure all the time. Like we live in this world where mostly we think about sex in its capacity to hurt. Even when we're talking about pleasure, there's all this terror about, you know, how it can hurt. And when we talk about food and pleasure, there's all this terror about how it might make us fat, which is, you know, fat phobia, of course, and how it might be unhealthy, and how intimacy, you know, is a chance for betrayal, all this stuff where, you know, maybe we could be doing it differently.
Yes, maybe we could be doing it differently and approaching it in ways that felt so nourishing and abundant, and oh, such a big yes to that.
Me too. I'm a yes. Sign us up for the post-apocalyptic.
We are ready. I would also love to know, just in your current iteration of life as it is right now, I'm so interested in the ways that we make space for pleasure, both the super tiny ones, you know, the smells and the colors we love, to the more grandiose and, you know, kind of luxurious treats that we might give ourselves. But what are some of the things that bring you pleasure these days?
Oh, that, you know, that's such a good and complicated question. You know, when I talk about a life, you know, where suffering and pain is at the center, I'll go ahead and say for the record that I've really, you know, ignored or struggled with accepting pleasure into my life for many reasons. I was raised in a, you know, extremely hardworking family where like pleasure, I think, was seen as like a, almost like as a sinful kind of thing. Like you're supposed to work hard, you know, like, and you have to earn tiny pleasures, and even those are indulgences, right? And then as a trans person, we have this really interesting thing in queer community where we spend lots of time talking about trauma.
Yes.
it's almost like you're not a real queer or trans person if you haven't experienced a massive trauma, right? And to talk about pleasures, small or grandiose, feel sort of like, indulgent or disrespectful of that. And, you know, we kind of worship pain in this way, as legitimizing, where, like, again, maybe we could be doing it differently, but, like, yeah, so I'm a workaholic, for sure. I'm just starting to steal back pleasure into my life. And so one of the, I think, like, the pleasure there for me is just kind of like being bad. You know, I think of it as being bad, which it's not, but, like, it's kind of fun for me to imagine it as bad. It's like weirdly kind of non-sexually kinky, where I'm like, oh, I'm being bad. I'm like going to sleep in and read a novel this morning, like something nerdy like that, right? Like I did that this morning, you know? I'm just getting back into reading for pleasure. I'm just getting back into drinking for pleasure. Like, you know, I have never used to allow myself like alcohol, except in these like weird moments as like a binge, right? And then that's a kind of sort of compulsive response that we have when we're deprived. So yeah, like I'm trying to learn how to take it slow and take pleasure in that, right? Like it's this ongoing dance of like, what does pleasure mean to me? And how do I steal? I love that notion of stealing back time for my pleasure. And I think again about, you know, I'm studying somatic sex education, which is like, you know, a pleasure-based sex education. And we've been doing a lot of talking about the spiral, like how we approach pleasure and sometimes it unfolds into pain, right?
Because of trauma.
I can sort of steal for myself a moment to have a glass of wine in the evening, and that's pleasure. And then it opens and I'm like, oh, like this pain I felt around feeling guilty about substance consumption or my past experiences with partners who have been addicted, you know, my trauma around that. And then, you know, stealing time to like kind of take care of myself around that, and then feeling guilty about taking care of it. Like it's this ongoing journey, and the greater pleasure for me is being on the journey, like walking through that spiral and just being like pleasure and then trauma and then pleasure and then trauma, and knowing, like learning, like sort of learning to trust that there will be pleasure again, you know, like there always can be again.
Yeah, because I know in my experience, and I'm sure people listening can relate, but it's so easy to feel trapped and or to get stuck in the hard stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I love how you're saying, like, let's trust that even when it's hard, it will become easy, or it will return to pleasure, and that we get to have this ebb and flow where it's not all pleasure all the time or all pain all of the time, but they're related. And so we move in and out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How it's going to be.
That's right. Well, I would love to respect your time and everyone else's time who's listening. You and I are going to go record a little bonus chat for Patreon supporters if you still have a couple minutes.
Absolutely.
Great. And I would love it if you could share with everyone how they can find you online, grab your new book, and find out all the things all about you.
Thank you. I love this question. And I have this weird answer to it that I'm going to give. Okay. So first of all, for those who need to run, you can find me at @razorfemme, like razor, like a razor shaving blade, and femme, like the French word for woman, razorfemme, on Twitter. That's pretty much my only like super public social media. I have like a public Facebook fan page, but like updates sporadic, you know. So, yeah, that's my social media. I don't have Instagram. Folks can also find me at my website, kaichengtom.com. Again, updates are sporadic, but like my general like kind of publishing history and link, some fun links and stuff are there. And then the weird part of this is like I would love if folks would check out my new book which is called I Hope We Choose Love. We gotta plug the title, you know, or any of my other books, but I don't know that I want people to find out everything about me. And I say this because, you know, I'm thinking lots about boundaries, which I think you probably talk a lot about on this podcast, you know,
indeed.
And there's this sense sometimes I get of people who, you know, like we live in like a public culture now where everyone's social media, where like, we think we just have access to anyone, especially if it's a person like me who's chosen in many ways a public life, that, you know, just like come at me and like, find out everything about me and my address and then like send me weird stuff in the mail, which has happened, unfortunately.
Oh my God.
Yes, it's really unfortunate. And certainly, you know, gotten a lot of emails that are, you know, too intimate for like this. I'm just gonna go ahead and say, like, you know, find me a little bit.
Yes.
But don't find me a lot. There's a part of me that must remain in secret. And I need people to respect that.
Yes, listeners, please do respect that. Grab Kai Cheng's books from the publishers and your favorite local independent bookstore. Follow on Twitter and attend talks if there's one in your city, and no creepy emails or gifts sent to anyone's house, please.
Yeah, don't send me any gifts to my house, please.
Oh, well, thank you to everyone who tuned in, and to you, Kai Cheng, thank you so much for being here with us and sharing so much beautiful wisdom and yummy food for thought. I really appreciate
it. Thank you so much for just letting me geek at you so hard for like an
Fuck
hour.
Fuck yes. Really. I am all about this. Awesome. Okay, well, everyone, thank you so much for being here. If you support the show on Patreon, head over there now and you can hear what Kai Cheng and I are about to go record. So stay tuned. Bye.
You used to light up like a spark. Now you're blue, treading water in the dark.
A huge thanks to the vocal Few, the married duo behind the music featured in this week's intro and outro. Find them at vocalfew.com. Head to patreon.com/sexgetsreal to support the show and get awesome weekly bonuses. As you look towards the next week, I wonder, what will you do differently that rewrites an old story, revitalizes a stuck relationship, or helps you to connect more deeply with your pleasure?
Ashamed. Love is supposed to be